Have you been sitting on the fence about signing up for the beta reader matchup, or have you signed up before but haven't yet found your writing soulmates? The next matchup is the last one for the summer, so don't snooze on it. Get matched up with those writing in a similar genre and or time zone so they can critique your work as you critique theirs. Your manuscript doesn't have to be complete to sign up for this 3,000-word evaluation. This particular matchup will be open to registrations from now until the 1st of June, with the matchup emails going out on the 2nd of June. For more information and to register, go to biancamaray.com and go to the Beta Reader matchup page.
What's up, everyone? This is Cece. So I recently grabbed lunch with an acquiring editor from HarperCollins who told me that the number of submissions she's been getting has nearly doubled. And I wasn't surprised at all because every agent and editor I know has been talking about how the volume of submission keeps increasing. So personally, that is a wonderful thing because it's more reading for me, but it also means I have more chances of matching with authors. I consider it a privilege to review queries on Books with Hooks and, of course, in my submissions inbox. But at the same time, I talk to writers who tell me that they wish agents would read more than a few pages because, and I quote, "my story gets better in chapter two." I have to be honest, this kills me. It's like me wanting chocolate chip cookies to have the nutritional value of kale. It's just not realistic. Like it or not, no agent, no acquiring editor is going to stick around to see if a submission gets better. It's not because we're mean, it's because we get dozens and dozens every day. I know it's harsh, but ambitious writers embrace harsh realities. So here it goes. It's your job to make your opening pages irresistible, to make agents crave it, to make agents want to read more. That's why I'm so excited about my upcoming course, Starting It Right, How to Begin Your Story in the Best Place and in the Best Way. I created this course after studying hundreds of books. I've mapped out elements that are present in the beginning of all successful novels and memoirs. And I've designed checklists, actual checklists, that you can use to ensure that your story's beginning is seducing your reader. We'll cover how to write a great first line, different types of beginnings, and how you can choose the best one, the best place to start, and the best way to start. Yes, these are totally different things. When it makes sense to add a prologue and when it doesn't, how to frame your inciting incident in an appealing way, how to balance exposition and mystery, how to include context but not weigh it down with too much backstory, and what to do if your story has more than one POV or timeline. Most of all, I'm going to show you how to make readers want to turn to chapter two. Join me for this multi-day course designed to help you break through the noise. You'll leave with a clear, actionable breakdown of exactly what goes into a terrific beginning. If you've already signed up, come prepared to take lots of notes. We're talking hundreds of slides with real-world examples and specific techniques, plus a super fun surprise that I can't wait to share. I hope to see you there.
Welcome to another episode of Shooting the Shit with literary agents Carly Waters and Cece Lira, where we dissect publishing gossip, discuss book industry trends, and the overall state of the book business. If you've ever wanted to grab a coffee with two literary agents, grab your mug and pull up a chair. Everybody, happy Monday. Thanks for hanging out. You have Carly and Cece here. And Cece's been running around New York for many, many events, and she's gracing us with her presence, everybody. We should feel so lucky that Cece's able to fit us into her busy schedule.
That is a very kind way to put it. Thank you for being so kind. Like, the train was late. I had to text you. You know this. To be like, I'm so sorry. I'm running late. I'm panting. Please don't watch this on YouTube, everyone. Yeah, not good.
I would like to go on the record saying that Cece agreed that she should do fitness. She should do exercise so that when she has to race through the city, that she will be fit enough to record with us. This is just a reminder, guys, that we fit this in, like, in our busy lives, our busy working lives. Like, we are usually on calls before or after reading things. We drop everything, you know, when we set aside our time to do this because we feel the responsibility to deliver you guys an episode every week. I don't know if you guys have known this, but we never miss. We never miss a week. We rearrange our schedules to make sure we make this happen for you guys because we care that much.
Yeah, and because it's so much fun. At least it is for me. Yeah. Yes. So thank you everyone for joining us.
Yes. Okay, so the first thing off the top today is, so I mean, I've been talking about this on Substack. This has been obviously going around the different agent chats, but the scams are really bad right now, guys. Really bad. I had a number of people get scammed by a fake me, somebody claiming to be me, somebody impersonating me. It's fraudulent. And so I want to talk about a couple situations about that. And I had a friend who's an agent and they emailed me saying, like, I know you have a big platform. Is there anything that you could do to bring more attention to how bad this is? And so this is me getting on my soapbox about this. Let's talk through some of the scams. Let's talk about red flags. Let's talk about what to look for in case anybody hasn't heard of any of these scams. I'll give you an example of one. So this is somebody who commented on my Substack. I've been trying, as I said, on Substack notes, you know, just doing whatever I can, talking about it on threads. So this is somebody who replied back to me on Substack. And they said, "Hi, Carly. A few days ago, I was contacted by someone impersonating Wendy McCurdy of Kensington Publishing." So I'm just going to pause here. So you're gonna see the chain of how this happens and how people kind of get sucked into these things. Because there are people impersonating multiple publishing professionals to kind of orchestrate this whole thing. Okay. So someone was impersonating Wendy McCurdy of Kensington Publishing. She said that she was interested in my YA novel, Diary of a Girl at the End of the World, and referred me to you to rep the deal. Except your email was CarlyWatters, so they misspelled my name, @gmail.com. And this person says, with an I, first red flag. The imposter you immediately go back to me, second red flag. I worked with Hollywood agents at CAA. Big agents never get right back to you. The fake you immediately referred me to someone to help shape my package, dun, 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 for a fee. Third red flag. I don't know how many red flags we're at this point. It was amateurish, but I imagine a lot of desperate writers fall for this scam. I was once contacted by someone wanting to access my screenplays. They pretended to be somebody at Netflix, sent me a fake Netflix contract. I contacted the real person at Netflix, confirmed it was a hoax. Having lived in LA, I can see scams coming. They still waste my time and are really annoying. I'm really sorry someone's been impersonating you, Carly. Later today, I'm going to inform fake Carly with an I that I have given their information to my sister, who's a special agent at the FBI. She is referring it to Cyber Crimes Division. Not really, but I'll make them think twice about trying it again. Yeah, so it's just such a bummer. This is an example, right? So it looks like multiple people are kind of connecting you. Eventually, they ask for money for these manuscript critiques. The manuscript critiques, and I've seen them, somebody else forwarded me one of these scams, and it's basically just like a ChatGPT quote-unquote analysis of your manuscript. So anyway, Cece, I'm sure you've seen these going around. Any further thoughts or red flags we should be looking out for here?
I mean, just this week, we got two emails from very helpful writers letting us know that someone was impersonating Wendy Sherman at Wendy Sherman Associates, obviously my agency, and we even posted on our Instagram, you know, to let people know. And it's, I mean, I really appreciate what this person said, because they said, yeah, it was amateurish, but she also has so much empathy for the people who are really eager to have a deal and to believe in good news. And so what makes me really angry, especially angry, because there's lots of things that make me angry, is that this is preying on people's vulnerability and people's dream of getting their work out there.
Yeah.
We hear all the time and we say it all the time. It only takes one yes. Keep going. Good news will come. You just have to keep believing in your dream. And the good news is going to come. And this is like, remember that person we had on Deep Dive once who got picked by Oprah's book club and she thought it was a prank?
Yeah.
Like, this was years ago. But like,
Jacqueline Mitchell.
You know what I'm saying? Like, this is like, I am trying to step into my optimism era and the scammers are not making it fun. So no, thank you, scammers. Thank you to everyone who's sharing about this.
I know. Somebody, because I always say also, like, email the agency if you think this has been a scam. Like, I don't want anybody to go blindly into anything, right? And somebody called the agency saying, "Did Carly Waters reach out to me? Because I got this message and I just wanted to be sure. And it seemed like an elderly lady. And I called her back and I was like, no, that wasn't me. I'm really sorry." But there is some, I mean, again, we're in our optimism era here. There is some good news. There has been people have been caught. This is a great story. So there's an article from the United States Attorney's Office, Southern District of California, press release that came out last week that said defendant pleads guilty in $48 million nationwide book publishing scam targeting hundreds of seniors. And so you can read the full article. I know there's been some news about this, but basically, you know, it shows that how people have been entrapping other people through this fraudulent behavior, but people are getting caught. But these scammers made $48 million on this scam. So we know how widespread it is. And as Cece said, preying on people's vulnerabilities, which is a bummer.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. Happy that some people are getting caught. Obviously, you know, it doesn't change the fact that a lot of people are still getting scammed, but it is good news.
All right, everybody, the next thing that we got sent to us was actually from a number of you. And I know that you guys know that we don't work on a lot of kid lit. We don't actually talk about that much kid lit on this show, just because it's not something that we encounter that much in our day. But a lot of you sent us this Mac Barnett quote, and you guys know which one I'm talking about. The quote going around was, 94.7% of kids' books are crud, end quote, Mac Barnett. So, you know, there's an Instagram from the account at Reading Middle Grade who really kind of got into it and had some thoughts about it. And I think it's an interesting carousel, and I will link to it so you guys can have a look at it. I mean, this person's like, you know, defends him a little bit. Obviously, it's rage bait. We're very aware of that. But I think it gets, I really like this carousel because it does get to the heart of the question, which is there too many books being published? And this conversation comes around in different ways every year. And I obviously don't want to defend what Max said. I also want to share his kind of apology. So he said, thank you for the opportunity to respond. First of all, I want to acknowledge the passage I wrote is hurtful, especially to people who work hard making books for kids. I understand why people are upset and feel betrayed. And trying to make a point, I got hyperbolic and glib. I was wrong. I'm truly sorry. So anyway, he did apologize for that. But Cece, the heart of the question or the heart of the statement or the heart of the discourse, I think centers around, you know, how many books are published. What did you think when you heard that or saw the discourse?
Yeah, I heard about it because you shared, which thank you. I don't know who this person is. I don't know who Mark Barnett is. Like, I don't seriously, I don't know. Should know. Is he famous? Who is he?
Yes, very well-known kid lit author. Yeah.
Okay, no idea who this person is. Hello, Mac? I don't know, whatever his name is. Like Big Mac, okay. Yeah, I do not represent children's books. And I mean, my experience with the children's books has been like buying books for my friend's kids, my nieces and nephews, and reading to my nieces and nephews and godchildren, which is very limited experience. I just generally don't think there are too many books being published because what I think is we need more readers, not fewer books.
Mm.
And also the idea of like too many, I think, misses the point, which is that every book is such a unique product and every book has a chance of reaching someone's heart. I understand again, don't know exactly what he said or the context of what he said, but I understand the logic of, well, if a space is flooded and there's too much choice, then does that make it harder for things to break out? I get that. I just don't think that given that self-publishing is a thing and given that content creation is so accessible to everyone, I don't think it's possible. Like the genie's not going to go back into the bottle. You know, we're not going to reduce the number of books, I think. So maybe it's just about reframing what makes for a successful book in people's minds. Maybe that's what it is a little bit. But yeah, how about you? What did you think?
I had a lot of thoughts about this. As I said, I think to me, the heart of the question is, are we publishing too many books? And we all know that there are so many wonderful books out there that there's just not a lot of ways for them to get coverage anymore. And so, I mean, there wasn't enough coverage for all of the wonderful books when we had a lot of print media coverage. And now we don't have a lot of print media coverage. So how are people finding out about these books, right? And this is the whole conversation around, you know, pivoting to digital and social media and author brands and self-publishing and everybody kind of being the digital entrepreneurs that they are. So yeah, and then there's obviously the whole self-publishing thing. So we know that there are just a lot of books out there. And so it comes back to the stats around the volume increase also of titles being published. I also shared in our little chat, Cece, a thread post, which kind of analyzes the increase of monthly releases of ebooks on Amazon, which I think is really interesting. Wow. So okay. This person, their account is AlexAndBooks_ on Threads. So okay. They said, we went from 100,000 new ebooks a month to 300,000. Thanks, ChatGPT. Basically, 2 out of 3 new books are now AI slop. And obviously, this is a visual medium. If you're watching us on YouTube, this is an audio medium. If you're listening to us on the podcast app, but there is a chart. And again, I'll link to this where you can see. So there's a chart that says, you know, units and then date. And then, you know, you can see there's a line of the year, the month that ChatGPT was released. Yeah. And then all of a sudden you see the delta just completely flare on the uptick. So clearly there are going to continue to be more titles than ever. So this isn't just a traditional publishing thing. This is like the amount of content out there is enormous. And so is it publishing's responsibility, traditional publishing's responsibility to like pull back and you know, and fine tune these lists, because we know that all of these books can't find readers. It's just not humanly possible. We just don't have enough hours in the day.
It's so complex. You know, like it's so complex. It's such a complex subject because it's just definitely not an easy yes or easy no, especially because to your point, I think you made a great point, is this is not just a trad pub thing. In fact, it's not just a pub thing. Like I remember reading that YouTube reported that over 500 hours of video are uploaded every minute.
Wow.
Okay. And this was, again, coming from YouTube. And think about it this way, like 500 hours versus 60 minutes, 30,000 hours of content, right? Like every hour in YouTube. And 30,000 hours of content times 24 hours in a day, that's 720,000 hours per day. So if every single day YouTube receives 720,000 hours of new content, that means that if someone wanted to watch the entirety of a single day of uploads, they would have to, like, watching 24 hours a day, which is not possible, right? They'll have to sleep. 720,000 divided by 24, 30,000 days, or approximately 82 years. Like one person.
Yeah.
Like one person.
Impossible. Yeah.
That's not, and if they were to watch it like 8 hours a day, that's 246 years. So YouTube uploads more content than a single person could watch in multiple lifetimes, like in a day,
Yeah.
You know? So, and that's just the world we live in. We live in a world of like content overload. And again, with AI, even more, because now you don't even need a human to do it. The robots are doing it themselves. AGI, even more, like it's going to just do it. And so, yeah, standing out, having a unique point of view, having a chance to even reach people, it's going to become rarer and rarer, which is not what I want to hear, what you want to hear. But I think it is the reality.
Yeah, and I think it just speaks to like what a privilege it is for, you know, the authors and the books and the work that we do when it really does connect with people. I really think it's such a privilege that, you know, when authors get to go on tour or they, you know, get to meet their fans in person, it really just brings to life how human this is. This isn't meant to be some AI slop world. You know, we didn't get into book publishing for that. You know, we got into book publishing for that personal connection and working on books that really connect with humans, not humanoid robots.
Exactly. Yeah. Yes. Here.
Yeah. All right. Okay. So, well, it wouldn't be a podcast episode unless we talked about a Substack. So the Substack that I wanted to talk about came across my desk is, the Substack is Notes from a Small Press, the author Anne Trubeck. It was published on May 5th, and I will link to it for you guys. Article is, "Are agents now the real publishers? ? And are publishers making themselves redundant?" So I saw this headline that's quite inflammatory, obviously, you know, and I was like, okay, this is a take. And I really had to sit with it. And I've been thinking about this for pretty much a week since we recorded last time or since it came across my desk. Because between school drop-offs, hitting the gym, and diving into client calls, I don't have the mental bandwidth for a wardrobe crisis. I need pieces that feel effortless and comfortable, but still look sharp. Quince has been my go-to for that, especially now as I'm counting the days until the summer finally hits. Their elevated fabrics make me feel put together without any overthinking. It's that rare combo when I know I look good, whether I'm chasing around my kids or sitting down for a meeting. Right now, I'm in the thick of balancing client work and triathlon training sessions, so my spring wardrobe has to do double duty. Quince makes that transition really easy with pieces that feel as good as they look. They're using high-end quality, 100% European linen, organic cotton, and ultra-soft denim, which is exactly what I need when I want to look sharp without feeling restricted. I'm a huge fan of wear on repeat items, and Quince's linen collection is the gold standard for that. Their lightweight pants, dresses, and tops just started $30. They're breathable and effortless, which is a lifesaver. Whether I'm recording an episode, headed to the gym, or just keeping up with my kids, it's an instant outfit that makes it getting out the door so much easier.
If you're like me and appreciate a smart financial move, you're going to love their model because everything at Quince is priced 50 to 80% less than similar luxury brands. They work directly with ethical factories and cut out the middlemen, so you're actually paying for the quality and craftsmanship rather than a brand markup. It's a high-end style that actually makes sense for a busy budget. I'm so eager for the weather to warm up so I can get my linen shorts on. Machine washable linen I can wear every day. Sign me up. I bought them in black, so they'll look classy with a black slide sandal, or I can pop on some running shoes and chase after the kids to the park. And the price, I had to double check because I was shocked at how affordable they are. I can't wait to wear my black linen shorts. Refresh your everyday with luxury you'll actually use. Head to quince.com/tisnatya for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. That's quince.com/tisnatya for free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/tisnatya.
Travel season is almost here. I've got my packing list and I'm ready to go. We just got back from a family weekend trip to Quebec to work on our French. Up next, a summer trip to Germany to introduce the kids to the Alps and hear a new language. Plus, our 10th anniversary trip to Italy later this year. I love hearing my Italian husband speak Italian. If you have travel coming up, join me in using Rosetta Stone to learn some local languages. There's something about summer that just feels like travel. Shake off the winter and get ready to move. Learning a new language is the perfect way to channel that momentum into a skill that opens up the world. Rosetta Stone has been a trusted leader in language learning for over 30 years. Their immersive, intuitive methods help you naturally absorb your new language without memorizing random vocabulary lists or relying on translations. Instead, you learn by connecting words, visuals, and meaning in context, the way language is meant to be learned. Working in the publishing business means my days are often packed with meetings and manuscripts, but I love how simple these lessons are to fit into my schedule. Whether I have 5 minutes between emails or an hour on the weekend, I can access my lessons from my desktop or the mobile app. Since we're heading to Italy, I've been using my true accent, which gives me real-time feedback on my pronunciation so I can sound more natural when we're visiting local vineyards. It's like having a personal coach to help me communicate with confidence. Rosetta Stone offers 25 languages to choose from, including Spanish, French, German, and Japanese, so you can find one that fits your next big adventure. Ready to start learning a new language this summer? Visit rosettastone.com/today to explore Rosetta Stone and choose the language that's right for you. Go to rosettastone.com/today now and begin your language learning journey. I posted like a note on Substack about it. And then I saw, and I was sitting with it, and then I saw Jane Friedman also, you know, did a kind of a quote take, a Substack notes about this. And so I want to pull out something that really stood out to me. It said, as I've been working through these thoughts and the history of others who have had such thoughts, better than and before me, I kept thinking of a phrase that a literary agent uses to describe the editing she does with clients before she sends a book out on submission. It goes something like, before I send it out, it has to be ready to go. That is, and this is a pretty big five specific phenomenon, the expectations are that editors at the press need a book to be done when they get a query. They won't do much editing. There's so much competition. So when an agent sends a manuscript to the editor, the book just needs to be about printer ready. Some copy editing and proofing, sure, but not much beyond that. But what does it mean for a book to be done when it has not gone through the publishing process? It means that what publishers do is not germane to the book itself. The publishers don't shape the manuscripts, that their work is less creative and more operational. So, I mean, it's a hot take. I think, you know, I never set out on this podcast to diss editors or say that they don't edit. That's never, of course, my intention. I just really think it's interesting when you frame it as how integral agents are to the publishing process. I mean, we know how integral we are to the publishing process. Do I think that I'm doing more work than ever to, quote, you know, get it ready to go, end quote? I don't know. I've always put a lot of polishing into the work that I've done. And I just want to read Jane Friedman's take from her Substack notes. When I first started working in publishing, authors never asked, what is the publisher for? But these days, when publishers say the manuscript needs to be ready to go, when authors hear that publishers don't reliably market and promote, when authors learn that most books sell on Amazon, et cetera, everything debatable with some truth, then authors ask more often, and rightly so, what is the publisher for? Layer on top of that how big publishers now sign successful indie authors for multi-book deals because those authors have done the hard part. They figured out how to reach their readers at a proven market demand.
Okay, interesting. I have not been sitting with this for a week. I read this today, the Substack. I have not read Jane's take other than what you read to me. To me, like you're reading it to me, you're reading it to our listeners. Sorry, listeners. But I respectfully, very respectfully disagree with Anne And Anne, I admire your point of view because I think that we need more people with specific and sharp point of views. And I definitely see where Anne is coming from. I do. I really do. But to me, while I was listening to you read that excerpt, here's my initial perspective. What Anne is saying makes sense, but I think the conclusion, like I disagree with the conclusion, because all the work that agents do to get something to be submission ready is so important. We are doing more work. This is true. I absolutely agree with that part. This is where you lose me though, you being Anne. I don't agree that publishers' work is more operational and not creative, because I have seen editors really, really edit and shape a manuscript, both in fiction and in nonfiction. And these projects are projects that I also, as an agent, put a lot of work into, because the nature of creative work means that it's never really finished or done. Like all the work I do brings it up to a certain point, and then it's not that I get it wrong or I do insufficient work. The editor then, it's kind of like a passing of the baton, you know? The editor takes over. Like the author qualifies and they join this league of like professional authors. And the editor, who's kind of like a coach of this league, this professional league, will take them even further. I'm doing a lot of creative work. I definitely don't think it's just pressing of a button. I agree with all the facts she laid out, the fact that it has to be super ready, the fact that it's super competitive, the fact that editors are truly very busy. But, you know, in the Substack, she mentioned things like, you know, should the agents just set up their own publishing houses and just keep more of the money? And I know that she was, and she does mention this in the article. She was like just sharing thoughts, right? Like she's not, you know, she's super open to thoughts and stuff. She made that very clear. But I think to me that kind of like, I think it's more about how we collaborate together than about one person doing the work of the other. I truly do. And I think that that's just the nature of creative work. I remember when we did, I think it was our first deep dive, and we were who was speaking? I'm pretty sure it might have been Sarah Canton at St. Martin's Press. And I think she was talking about, I don't remember what book she was talking about, but she was talking about a book where she had a vision for the book. And her vision was so specific that the author was adding a whole new timeline. And I remember a lovely, lovely person who was attending the deep dive saying in the comments, but hey, if the agent got it wrong and the agent didn't tell her to add a timeline, what hope do we have, we writers? And I'm like, you're looking at this the wrong way. The agent didn't get it wrong. Like that was a specific vision Sarah brought in through her world perspective. If it had been a different editor, an equally talented editor, they might have brought a different vision, and that wouldn't have been wrong or right. Like that's just not how it works. You know, we're not solving a math equation. So I think, you know, to answer the big question of the Substack, are agents now the real publishers? No. And are they making themselves redundant? I also don't think so. I see it differently, I think, but I definitely appreciate Anne's take.
Yeah, I mean, I guess what I bump up against is, in the long-term view of many authors' careers, they're going to go through many editors. They're going to go through multiple publishing houses. And in an ideal agent-author situation, the agent is going to be the constant, you know, through it all. And that means that the agent then has to help them develop the new ideas, you know, work on the option project that maybe doesn't sell or does sell, and then move on to the next one. And that's what we're paid for. Like, that's our job. And I don't think it replaces the publisher, but I do think that I appreciate maybe her pointing out how much freaking work we do. Towards the end of the article, she said, there's a lot of threads I could keep pulling here, but I'll end by underlining how much intensive work happens between author and agent, especially when the goal is a big five contract. That's where a book is given a form, by definition, a generic one. A manuscript can then be plopped into one of a dozen imprints. Do we need that imprint? I mean, obviously we do, because that's the function of the publisher, is to publish the book.
You know, I think what she ended up doing, maybe this was her intention, maybe it wasn't, was highlighting a huge misconception people have, which is that, oh, the editor edits, meaning only the editor edits. And that's not true. Agents are very editorial. Not every agent is editorial, but many are. Most that I know, in fact. And, you know, when someone thinks of an agent, they might think of like a real estate agent. Like no one's going to help you build a house to sell the house. You know, that's not how it works. But yes, we do. We do a lot of editing, and I 100% appreciate that, like her highlighting how much work we do. I just don't think it's in substitution. I think it is a response to a competitive market, but that just means that more work is needed, not that the work came all to the hands of, or went all to the hands of the agent, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
yeah, it does. But I'm still thinking about this. A lot of thoughts.
Yeah, that one kind of sat with me a while. Again, yeah. Obviously we know how much work we do. And then I was thinking, like, project by project, I'm like, you know, what is the lift that everybody does? And they're actually completely different. You know, the lift we do to get it to the book deal stage is very different than the lift that the developmental editor does, that the copy editor does, that the proofreader, you know what I mean? There's so many layers to this, and it's really true. Is a team effort, and we all got to be rowing in the same direction in order to make it happen. All right, folks. Well, that is everything that we have for today. It's a short and sweet app. And Cece is off to her next event, and we will see you guys all again next week.
Do you know where I'm about to go?
Where are you about to go?
To a cafe that has an amazing chocolate chip cookie to meet with an acquiring editor so we can eat chocolate chip cookies and Brigadeiros. I also have Brigadeiros.
Of course.
Yes. So, you know, lots of sugar. Lots of sugar.
Have a cookie for me, and I will see you next week.
Cece Lira is a literary agent at Wendy Sherman Associates. If you'd like to query Cece, please refer to the submission guidelines at www.wsherman.com. Carly Waters is a literary agent at PS Literary Agency, but her work on this podcast is not affiliated with the agency, and the views expressed by Carly on this podcast are solely that of her as a podcast co-host and do not necessarily reflect the views, opinions, policies, or position of PS Literary Agency. Have you been sitting on the fence about signing up for the Beta Reader matchup, or have you signed up before but haven't yet found your writing soulmates? The next matchup is the last one for the summer, so don't snooze on it. Get matched up with those writing in a similar genre and or time zone so they can critique your work as you critique theirs. Your manuscript doesn't have to be complete to sign up for this 3,000-word evaluation. This particular matchup will be open to registrations from now until the 1st of June, with the matchup emails going out on the 2nd of June. For more information and to register, go to biancamaray.com and go to the Beta Reader matchup page.
What's up, everyone? This is Cece. So I recently grabbed lunch with an acquiring editor from HarperCollins who told me that the number of submissions she's been getting has nearly doubled. And I wasn't surprised at all, because every agent and editor I know has been talking about how the volume of submission keeps increasing. So personally, that is a wonderful thing, because it's more reading for me, but it also means I have more chances of matching with authors. I consider it a privilege to review queries on Books with Hooks, and of course, in my submissions inbox. But at the same time, I talk to writers who tell me that they wish agents would read more than a few pages because, and I quote, "my story gets better in chapter 2." I have to be honest, this kills me. It's like me wanting chocolate chip cookies to have the nutritional value of kale. It's just not realistic. Like it or not, no agent, no acquiring editor is going to stick around to see if a submission gets better. It's not because we're mean, it's because we get dozens and dozens every day. I know it's harsh, but ambitious writers embrace harsh realities. So here it goes. It's your job to make your opening pages irresistible, to make agents crave it, to make agents want to read more. That's why I'm so excited about my upcoming course, Starting It Right: How to Begin Your Story in the Best Place and in the Best Way. I created this course after studying hundreds of books. I've mapped out elements that are present in the beginning of all successful novels and memoirs. And I've designed checklists, actual checklists, that you can use to ensure that your story's beginning is seducing your reader. We'll cover how to write a great first line, different types of beginnings, and how you can choose the best one, the best place to start, and the best way to start. Yes, these are totally different things. When it makes sense to add a prologue and when it doesn't, how to frame your inciting incident in an appealing way, how to balance exposition and mystery, how to include context but not weigh it down with too much backstory, and what to do if your story has more than one POV or timeline. Most of all, I'm going to show you how to make readers want to turn to chapter 2. Join me for this multi-day course designed to help you break through the noise. You'll leave with a clear, actionable breakdown of exactly what goes into a terrific beginning. If you've already signed up, come prepared to take lots of notes. We're talking hundreds of slides with real-world examples and specific techniques, plus a super fun surprise that I can't wait to share. I hope to see you there.